today we're going to do all the verses. I don't want to lose touch with like with the earlier verses. So we'll do them, you know, once a month or so, everything. So the seven preliminary verses and then the three verses of the three levels of motivation, the three sort of stages of entering the path. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free for that without distraction day and night to study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami, and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To give up all my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in dharma dawns and thrives. On solitude and silence to rely, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness, a guest, will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims. Not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane, constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. To hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Who can the worldly deities protect, themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail. To seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts to be free, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. My mother's each and every sentient being, since time without beginning cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. My mother's each and every sentient being, since time without beginning cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. My mother's each and every sentient being, since time without beginning, cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. I don't know if you're getting background noise from me at the moment. My fan is running on my computer, and sometimes that makes some noise. So I apologize if it does. I think it was probably the share screen used up a little extra something. All right, so the pop quiz, I don't know if people have had a chance to look at the verse 10 notes online, but it included a pop quiz, silent pop quiz, and it's an important one. This particular verse, we're getting into now, like, Mahayana motivation. Verses 10 and 11 are about establishing that, so that we can then continue the path with the aspiration to bring all sentient beings with us. And the way that I see it, I think it's helpful to look at verse 10 as cultivating love, which is the wish for all beings to be happy. That's what the verse says. How can I be happy? How can I enjoy the happiness of awakening if my mothers from all previous lives are suffering? So it's the wish to bring all beings with us to happiness. And then verse 11 is going to introduce taking and sending, exchanging one's own happiness for the suffering of others. And so that is compassion. They're both like very intertwined, but I find it helpful to look at them this way. And I just wanted to bring in the jewel ornament, the ornament of precious liberation here again, because Gampopa has a very helpful delineation, which I know I've mentioned before in this class, of the why we're not awake. Like, even if we're a Dharma practitioner, why are we not a Buddha yet? And he said there are four obstacles that prevent us from being fully awake. So our quiz here, especially for those of us who have studied that topic in the Ornament of Precious Liberation, is can we bring those four obstacles to mind? What are they? And if you haven't had that teaching, then you can't. But you might imagine what they might be. Like, why wouldn't we be awake if we're a Dharma practitioner? If you have pencil and paper, you might want to write them down. I find it a little hard to focus in the context of the class. Like, my mind wants to, like, not focus on the list. But so the first obstacle, and so the reason that I'm bringing this up now in this context is that love and compassion are the antidote to one of the three obstacles. And it's one that we've talked about before. I'm thinking it was Patrick who raised the question about one of the obstacles a while back, so I'm sorry he's not with us today, but we have talked about it. So the first obstacle is being too busy, being just too caught up in our worldly activities, not having any time to devote to Dharma practice. And again, this is one of those lists I really recommend everybody memorize. Just know these four obstacles, because then you can recognize them as they arise. The antidote to being too busy for Dharma practice, for study, contemplation, and meditation, is to understand impermanence. That there's no time. Our worldly activities will, as Dr. Wong, the Vietnamese doctor in Vermont that a lot of people at the monastery see, as he once said to one of us who said she was too busy to follow his instructions, he said, all your work will still be there when you die. So a second obstacle is if we're not too busy, we're too distracted. We want to use our time for something else. Like so many video games, so little time. And the antidote to that is twofold. It is understanding karma That we're creating a certain kind of future for ourselves if we give in constantly to distraction. And it may not be the future that we want or say that we want. And then the other one is understanding the suffering of samsara, which was addressed in the previous verse a little bit. In fact, the two previous verses were it. 8 was karma, and 9 is the suffering of samsara and impermanence. So we have two obstacles and two antidotes. Third obstacle is a little harder to understand, and that's the one Patrick had the question about, although it wasn't in this context. It is working only for our own benefit, traveling the path only for our own awakening. It's what's called like the object of that, like the result of that path of working only for our own benefit, which is still huge. It's still way better than most of us do. It's the awakening of our own arhat. It's just freeing oneself from suffering. It's not complete liberation, as we've learned in verses 8 and 9. And it's also referred to as one-sided nirvana, and that's what Patrick asked about a while back, was what was one-sided nirvana. I think it was referred to in the Ornament of Precious Liberation. And that's it, is attaining liberation for oneself, which is verse 8. Like I just don't want to suffer. How do I get out of this thing? And the antidote to that is the answer to part 2 of our pop quiz, cultivating love and compassion, bringing everybody with us, cultivating the wish for everyone to be happy. So you couldn't go on without bringing them with you. You couldn't save only yourself, knowing that everybody else is left behind, stuck in samsara and suffering. And compassion, the wish to free everybody from suffering, basic practice of Chenrezig. And then what could the fourth obstacle be? What's left? The fourth obstacle is just not knowing how to attain liberation, how to travel the Bodhisattva path. And that's why Gampopa wrote the whole rest of his book, which he probably didn't write as a book. Somebody probably took notes, requested the teachings and took notes, and it became the book that's attributed to Gampopa, because it's his teachings. That's my assumption. I don't really know. I'm not that much of a scholar. Yes, I'll unmute you, Marilyn.
I'm a little, it seems that by making these four antidotes to the four obstacles, and the last one being developing the ignorance and developing bodhicitta, it seems like if we divide it up this way, aspiration bodhicitta working for your own benefit, and that's not quite right. If the antidote to the ignorance of the path is developing bodhicitta, mm-hmm. developing love and compassion is part of aspiration bodhicitta, then you see what my problem is?
It sounded to me like you were saying that aspiration bodhicitta does not include other beings. Did I misunderstand that?
Loving kindness and compassion are part of aspiration bodhicitta, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So they're linked up with the obstacle of working for one's own benefit. Mm-hmm. But bodhicitta, so that says, and that's called aspiration bodhicitta, right?
Right.
So the next ignorance of the path that leads to Buddhahood is developing bodhicitta. So that means it's action bodhicitta and not aspiration bodhicitta?
I think you may be overthinking it, which is something I do a lot. I don't think it divides up that neatly.
Okay.
I don't think we need to worry about that. It's all, by definition, it's work all about others, because it wouldn't be bodhicitta without that. And we're hopefully going to have a chance to look at that in one of the commentaries where it's very clearly expressed.
I can live with that.
Okay. And we can explore it further. I don't want to take time now, but just that's sort of the basic answer. It's all the same. Aspiration and action, it's all the same intention. It's all based on love and compassion, because it wouldn't be bodhicitta without it. And I don't know at this point if that's answering your question.
It's good enough.
Okay, good. All right, anybody else? Richard, I'm unmuting you.
When I was younger, and I think it still exists, there was this magazine that would get left at the house sometimes, Awake. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the church that puts it out.
Is that the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Maybe. I always remember this cover of one of them. I guess it was during Revelations, and everybody's in heaven. Well, some people. They pull back the curtain, and they're looking at the suffering on earth, and they're all so happy, you know, that they're up in heaven. And even at a young age, I thought, it's so selfish. How can you be happy when you're looking at that, you know?
Yeah.
It's just an observation that that it's pretty... Bodhicitta is pretty obvious, kind of. How could you be happy?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't really speak to other religions, but...
No, I'm just saying it was obvious to me then that even if I went to heaven, if somebody else wasn't in heaven, I really wouldn't be able to be happy. You know?
Yeah, well, that's the basic realization of bodhicitta, but even within Buddhism, we have... You know, we don't always have that. That's a Mahayana thing. And it's not saying that, you know, people who practice, you know, a narrower path, a path that's focused more on individual liberation, doesn't mean they're necessarily happy that other people are suffering. They may not yet see the possibility of opening up their perspective.
I guess I'm saying it was clear to me even then.
But, you know, I'm thinking, like, if I were stuck in the hell realm... And I got out. My first reaction would be great relief, you know?
Yeah.
And then maybe I would take a look and realize that, you know, it wasn't complete happiness because something.
Somebody asked one of the Rinpoches why we don't see many ghosts.
Uh-huh.
And he said, if you were stuck in a briar patch for, you know, thousands of years and you finally got out, would you go back to visit?
Yeah, and that's the one-sided nirvana. It's a very pleasant state. You know, there's a lot to be happy about when you're free from suffering.
Yeah.
But and that's like, there's a beautiful passage. I can't remember. I think we've talked about this before. I can't remember if it's in the Jewel Ornament in the, you know, the first chapter on Buddha Nature about the five families, the five different kinds of connections you can have through awakening. It might be in a practice that we did in retreat, but... There's this image of the Buddha like sending light and this one-sided nirvana person who's enjoying their own freedom from suffering and completely just focused on that. They're illuminated by this light sent by the Buddha and they realize that they're not fully awake yet and that they have some more work to do. And that directs them to the Mahayana path. So everybody always has the potential. But my God, as a teacher that I used to study with, a Western teacher, used to say, like, an arhat is so far ahead of us. Like, we can't look down on arhats. But what they've achieved is absolutely amazing. And if we could do that, it would be so wonderful. And then we can look, you know.
I hope you didn't understand. That wasn't my point.
As Mahayana practitioners, we're encouraged to look at the beginning, you know, and as we set out on the path, we're including everybody. Sorry, Richard, I think you said something else.
I said that wasn't my point in bringing up the magazine. It was just kind of obvious to me, even at a young age,
right,
that I wouldn't be able to be happy without bringing some people with me. Yeah, that's all.
So you were a natural Mahayanist. I mean, you were born already with that perspective. You probably had a connection with Mahayana in previous times. I think that's what Laman Rawalpindi said. You know, it shows
because it wasn't taught to me in church.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
Okay.
And I think it led to a good discussion. Or maybe it was only me talking. Okay, anybody else before we, let's see what we're doing next. Okay. Right, I'm going to mute you again, Richard, but, you know, everybody can always unmute. All right, so we're going to look at some commentaries today. And I have a note to myself to review the structure, but we kind of already did that. So we have the seven preliminary practices, which we never want to lose sight of. I mean, really, I would hope that everybody at this point, if, you know, I said, what's the fourth practice of a bodhisattva? You would go, Dan, to let go of attachment to this life, you know, that we know them all that well. If you and you know, it's not something you have to force. If you chant the practices regularly, maybe not every day, I don't even get to them every day at this point, but if you chant them, regularly and you review them regularly, you don't have to like force it into your brain, like cramming it. It's just, it will naturally be there. The second practice of a bodhisattva, to give up all my habits and reactions, to leave the homeland, to leave my homeland. Seventh one, this one, for some reason, I always leave out. Like I walk through the churchyard, the Baptist church across the street, and I'm chanting these to myself. And I always leave out refuge. And I go back, oh, wait, I forgot number seven. To seek refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or to take refuge in the three jewels. So let's keep them that, you know, fresh in our minds. And then the second group, which we're coming to the end of this week, is the basic motivations for traveling the path. So we have to go through that evolution, and we have to keep the foundation of verse 8, which is about freeing ourselves from suffering by refraining from harm. That's the foundation of our entire path, is not to harm other beings. Without that, the other two don't lead anywhere. So not to harm others, verse 8, that's our first motivation. We got that down. We're doing our best to not engage in the 10 negative actions. And then we realize that even our happiness in samsara is fleeting. And sometimes, you know, the classic image is it's like a razor blade, like honey on a razor blade. And so then we resolve to liberate ourselves completely from samsara. That's verse 9, to strive for complete liberation for, I think there's highest liberation. I forget how I have it written. And then now we're at the 10th one, where it becomes a full Mahayana motivation, not just freeing ourselves from samsara. We're still doing that. We're still refraining from harm. We're still striving for liberation. But now we're bringing everybody with us, because how could we be free? We can't be free. We can't be free if we don't work to liberate everybody. So that's the structure of these three verses. And then with the next verse, we really step out on the path. We're Mahayana, and now we get to do Mahayana work. So we're going to look at the commentaries. And again, just let me know if you have anything to say or ask. Look first at Dingo Chense Rinpoche. I'm just hitting the highlights, because I want to have some time for anything anybody wants to talk about or share. And because everybody will have read the commentary themselves by now, and maybe different things jumped out at you. And as Kathy did a couple of weeks ago, you know, sharing with us a passage from Ken McLeod's commentary that she had found especially helpful, please feel free to do that, because I may not pick out the same parts as you that I find very meaningful. So I'm going to start reading at the beginning. I'm going to read the first two paragraphs on page 98. In the first one, he states the problem. And Kala Rinpoche stated this in a really nice way. Somebody once asked him if he could just sum up Buddhism in one sentence. Like, what's the point? And unfortunately, I didn't have time to seek out that particular quote, but this is what he said, basically, in different words. So the absolute nature of everything is primordially pure, free of all conditions, and beyond any concepts of existence and non-existence. So that is the way everything ultimately is. That is freedom. Within relative truth, self and others, suffering and happiness manifest in infinite ways. These appearances in relative reality, are devoid of any true existence. They have no ultimate, permanent, lasting, unchanging existence. Yet beings believe them to be true and thus wander deluded in samsara. That's where all our suffering comes from, is thinking relative reality is real. It's solid, it's real, it's the way it appears to me in this moment, and forgetting ultimate reality. So I'm not going to read from Ken McLeod today. I don't know if people who have the book have had a chance to look at this verse, but he has a lovely meditation at the beginning of it. And if anybody has the book, I encourage you to do that meditation. And what it basically is he sets you up to simultaneously hold, at least momentarily, both ultimate and relative bodhicitta, both the ultimate perspective and the relative perspective. And you get, like, that gives you a glimpse of what we're working towards, is to be able to hold both at the same time, no matter what is happening to us at any given moment. We always are in touch with the knowledge that there's no solid, permanent, fixed reality to it, and that it might even not really look the way it's looking to us right now. So that's the problem, is that we take relative reality for the whole story, and we don't have the perspective of ultimate reality, which, as I said before, does not negate or trump relative reality. It's not higher, it's just another dimension of our reality. And the more that we're in touch with that, the less solid things seem, and therefore the less we suffer. So what do we do to get out of this fix? That's the next paragraph. So Dingo Chensei Rinpoche says, the bodhicitta of intention, of aspiration, has two aspects. And this is probably what Marilyn was referring to. Is Marilyn still with us? So we lost somebody. Oh, there's Marilyn. Okay, we lost somebody, but I'm not sure who it was. The bodhicitta of intention, of aspiration, has two aspects. Compassion, which is directed toward beings, and wisdom, which is directed toward enlightenment. All right, I tend to equate enlightenment with full awakening, like with both things together. So I would, this is like how someone translated it. I might not say it that way, but I don't know what he said exactly. But anyway, in aspiration, bodhicitta has two aspects, compassion and wisdom. Neither aspect by itself, neither the mere wish to benefit beings through compassion, nor the mere wish to attain enlightenment, or like seeing things the way they really are, expresses bodhicitta. Neither one alone is bodhicitta. On the one hand, if you do not aim at attaining ultimate enlightenment, then however strong your wish to benefit beings may be, you will never go beyond ordinary kindness and compassion. So without wisdom, without the ultimate bodhicitta perspective, we can help people, but we can only help them in a very limited way because we don't see clearly what is really needed. We may not. We may be able to do an awful lot of good without that, but we can't ultimately help them. So that's compassion without wisdom. On the other hand, if you wish to attain enlightenment for your own sake alone, what we call one-sided nirvana, you will never go beyond the limited nirvana of Hinayana practitioners. Both aspects are indispensable. So we have to cultivate both wisdom, seeing things the way that they are in an unconfused way, and compassion. This is expressed in the ornament of true realization, which is not the same as the ornament of precious liberation. Bodhicitta is to aspire to enlightenment for the benefit of others. That's the definition. We get into that a little bit more clearly, perhaps. I mean, a little more detail in Transforming the Heart, which we'll get to next. So I'm looking at page 100 now. I wanted to pick up, I think this is the last thing I'm picking up from Dingo Chensei's commentary for now, which I think is really helpful. Again, he's talking about being able to help people in just worldly, ordinary ways where we can indeed do a lot of good, and it's very important to do that, versus also being able to bring in the wisdom perspective. So he says, a bodhisattva benefits all beings equally without discriminating between enemies and friends. That's big right there. Like, we help everybody. We don't stop to ask whether they're a Republican or a Democrat, or whether, you know, they're abusing their children, or, you know, we just help everybody however presents itself. Giving food, clothes, and the like to others can only bring them temporary and limited relief. It does not help them at the moment they die, nor after their death. Lama Norla once said to me, the question that was always coming up before he started making people lamas, like as to what a lama really is, like what makes a person a lama. And he said to me, a lama is somebody who can help someone after they die. You're not a lama if you can't do that. So you can do a lot of good, again, by sending money for Hurricane Harvey victims and giving people food, giving money to the homeless person on the street corner and so forth. But it's relative benefit. It's limited benefit. Not to discount it, but just to recognize its limitations. But if you can establish all beings in the Dharma, you will help them in a way that is both immediately beneficial and beneficial for their future lives. Practicing the Dharma enables them to free themselves from samsara and achieve enlightenment. So that is the way to truly repay your parents' kindness. Any other way is not enough. So he's not saying other ways are not good. He's just saying they're not the whole deal. They're not sufficient. Like, so this again, you know, is an answer that one could give when someone says, why are you wasting your time meditating when there's so many people in the world who need help? And actually, Geshe Jampa Tegshok is going to help us with that too. We need both. We need both. And that's sort of the theme of today's verse and commentaries, is we need both. We need to help people, but we also need to put time and effort into cultivating a greater perspective, the ultimate perspective, cultivating wisdom so that we can see what's needed and that we can help people beyond fulfilling their immediate needs. So does anybody have any comments or questions before we go to Geshe Jampa Tegshok? Yeah, Dan, I'm going to unmute you. Okay.
Yeah, going back to verse 5 about negative friends. And then, yeah. You know, but, you know, you don't discriminate between enemies and friends, it says. So, I mean, I still struggle with negative friends in my life. And so, I don't know, I guess it's just, I don't know, it's difficult.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't know.
No, it's just sharing something from your experience is helpful to all of us. You know, that's what we're here for. Yeah, it's a practice. You know, it's a path of practice. And everything is not clear. We don't have fully developed wisdom yet or fully developed compassion. So we just do our best. You know, to see what's best in the present moment, but always with the idea that we aren't rejecting people.
I think that's,
We disentangle ourselves from being influenced by them. We can still have a warm and loving relationship with them.
Yeah, this part of me tends to feel like there's that tinge of, you know, like I need to, I guess, reject them a little. You know, I don't want to do that, though, obviously.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. The only time you have to do that is when you really can't get out from under their influence. Maybe they're very aggressive.
And I've had that in my life, yeah.
Yeah, maybe you can't handle the level of influence that they're having at that moment, and you might have to take a break, but you still consciously, you don't reject them. You just think you need a break.
Okay.
That's my thought.
Yeah, it's good. It's helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, so we're going to look at Geshe Jampa Tegshok, Transforming the Heart, which more and more I'm just really liking his presentation. We actually, Anne, I don't know if you remember, but when we studied the 37 practices way, way back when, in the early days of the New Hampshire Center, we used this book. This was one of the resources we used because Chuck had it in his immense library of Dharma books. And that's where I found this book. That's how I know this book exists, is because of Chuck Wimette and the New Hampshire Sangha. So if anybody has this book, I'm on page 157, and his chapter here is called Generating the Altruistic Intention. Again, he's a Galugpa, a very well-respected Galugpa teacher, and this book is translated by Thubten Chodron, who's familiar to many of us. So he begins by saying, we have now covered the practices for the initial and middle-level practitioners. So that's the other way of dividing it up, is the three levels of practitioners as opposed to the three levels of motivation. Same practitioner, three levels of motivation. He said, these are the basis for the practices of the advanced level practitioner. So again, that's something that we've discussed a few times. We're not abandoning these two levels of motivation. We're building on them. Each one builds on the last, just as the Vajrayana is built on the Mahayana, which is built on the Shravakayana or Hinayana. We're not abandoning or negating or looking down on anything, you know, we're just building, always building up. So these are the basis for the practices of the advanced level practitioner, which is us, or the Mahayana practitioner. The Mahayana considers the Mahayana to be the most advanced level of practice. That's not surprising. And hello to Sue Gately. So he said, now in speaking of the third level, we will learn how to generate bodhicitta, which can be translated as altruistic intention or awakening mind, and then how to familiarize ourselves with it and apply it. Bodhicitta is the essence of the universal vehicle, the Mahayana. So what is bodhicitta? He's going to give us a really interesting, I think, explanation of how bodhicitta develops. It's very short. It's on page 158. He says, there were some things that came before it. He says, thus we see that having a kind heart is a great quality, but it is not bodhicitta. So having a warm, kind heart is part of bodhicitta, but it's not bodhicitta itself. It's not, again, it's not sufficient. It's a good thing, but it's not sufficient to be bodhicitta, just to be a kind person. So what is bodhicitta? Oh, he says, similarly, neither the aspiration to benefit others nor the aspiration to become a Buddha is bodhicitta, neither one alone. And here's where it gets interesting. The aspiration to benefit all beings is a cause of bodhicitta. It occurs prior to it, not at the same time. However, when based on that aspiration to benefit others, we generate a primary consciousness with the aspiration to become a Buddha, then we have generated full-fledged bodhicitta. Okay, so what he's saying there is that first we are moved by the suffering of others. That's where it all comes from. The aspiration to attain enlightenment, according to him, according to this reasoning, comes from the wish to benefit others, the wish to help free others from suffering, all levels of suffering, and realizing that the only way to do that is to put on your own oxygen mask first, which is to attain wisdom yourself. So you have to attain wisdom in order to know how to free beings from suffering, and that is the essence of bodhicitta. You have to have both things, that's wisdom and compassion, but he says compassion comes first. And I've never heard this presentation. It may be a specifically Galupa kind of presentation, but often it's the same in all lineages, but each lineage has its different emphases and its different wordings. So I just found that a really interesting and slightly different formula. I see Sita Rinpoche whenever he teaches. It was this way 20 years ago, and it was this way when he came to visit for the first time in 17 years, a year ago this month at KTC. Wait, I think it was Minjir Rinpoche, and I know Marilyn was in the audience and knew the answer. He said, what is a bodhisattva, or what is a bodhicitta? And he's very, interactive, and so he wanted people to say, and, nobody was coming up with the right definition. And Marilyn was there, and I think she didn't answer out of, wanting to give other people a chance. Oh dear, I've activated Siri somehow remotely. She's transcribing me. Only Marilyn knew the answer, which was it's the wish to attain enlightenment in order to help all other beings attain enlightenment. And that's the piece that Sita Rinpoche is very adamant that we not forget. It's not to wish to attain enlightenment in order to help other beings. That's not enough. It's to wish to attain enlightenment in order to help other beings attain the same level of freedom and awakening. That makes it bodhicitta, all of those elements together. So I'm looking for the next passage. Okay, so here we have again talking about the difference between helping people in a general way and helping people in a dharmic way. Sort of why you need both dharma practice and activity to help people. He says, if someone is hungry, it is definitely better to give him food rather than to simply wish he had some. The aspiration for somebody to have food when they're hungry is not enough. It doesn't really help them. I wish he had a sandwich. So you get them a sandwich or whatever. He said, it is good to help in a practical way whenever we can. Yet, in the long run, it is more beneficial to give, in the long run, is it more beneficial to give food, medicine, material goods, and so on to those who are in need? Or is it better to develop bodhicitta and then be able to offer more extensive help?
I think the ultimate answer is it's not either or, but it leads us to an interesting situation in the next paragraph. So he goes on to say, when we help others with material things, their suffering is eliminated, but only temporarily. They will get hungry again, fall ill again, or experience various other problems. However, through the force of the altruistic intention, through bodhicitta, wishing to attain enlightenment in order to help them attain enlightenment, we will dedicate ourselves to help others remove the root cause of all their sufferings in cyclic existence, the self-grasping ignorance. By cultivating bodhicitta, we will make ourselves capable of helping others in a very vast way over a long period of time without getting discouraged. He goes on to say, of course, this does not mean we content ourselves with meditating on compassion and ignore the suffering going on around us. So I'm going to break here before I finish this paragraph and look at the Ornament of Precious Liberation. Page 171, if you happen to have that handy, Kampopa. This is the Paramita of Ethics. I talk about this a lot, and I just wanted to read it to you because it also answers the same question. So, let me see. I need a little help here. One second on the three aspects. Okay, the three aspects. Okay, there are three aspects to the Paramita of morality or ethics. And the three aspects are the moral discipline of restraint, which is whatever level of vows you take, even if it's the vow to refrain from the 10 on virtuous actions. It's like that, whatever your basic moral framework is for yourself. Second aspect of ethics is the moral discipline of amassing virtues, collecting virtue, collecting merit. It's basically your own bodhisattva training. Training yourself as a bodhisattva, studying the Dharma and so forth. And then the third piece of it is the moral discipline of working for the welfare of others. And that's the order of them. Like first you have to decide what you're doing, like what are your ethics? What are you vowing to do? Second, you train yourself to do it in the best way possible. And third, you put it into practice for the benefit of others directly. So on page 174. Okay, so he quotes here from a text called The Bodhisattva Levels. The following, and this is, so the first one, the like deciding what your level of vows is, we don't need to talk about that, but we're going to talk about the training yourself as a bodhisattva piece. So this says, the following is to be understood as being the bodhisattva's moral discipline of amassing what is virtuous. Relying on and abiding within the bodhisattva's moral discipline, it is to enthusiastically apply yourself to study, contemplation, and meditation. Where have we heard that before? And to maintain solitude. This is all in our preliminary practices of the 37 practices. This is the training in the bodhisattva path. It is to respect gurus and to serve them and to serve and care for the sick. It is to give properly, generosity, and proclaim good qualities. We'll be hearing more about that in the 37 practices. To appreciate the attributes of others and to be patient with those who are scornful. It is your basic bodhisattva training, your basic dharma practice. It is to dedicate virtue to enlightenment and make earnest prayers to that end, to make offerings to the three jewels and strive to be diligent, to be ever caring and careful, to be mindful of the training and through awareness to keep to it. To guard the doors of the senses and to know how much to consume, to not sleep in the first and last parts of the night, but to persevere in joining the mind with what is wholesome. That's like a monastic discipline, and so forth. So these sorts of qualities need to be practiced, nurtured, and thoroughly increased. And that is how we make ourselves able to fully benefit other beings. We cannot ignore this aspect of ethics. So then the third, the moral discipline of working for the welfare of others, can be known in brief in terms of 11. And as we've learned when we've studied the Ornament of Precious Liberation before, in some lists it's 13, depending on how it's translated. So I'm going to just read part of them. So this is how, like, the Buddha himself taught that we should help other beings in conjunction with our training to cultivate wisdom. So he said we should support those doing worthwhile activities, such as Dharma activity, I guess, remove the suffering of beings in torment. So if we see someone suffering, we help them. To teach those without skill how to deal with things intelligently, mentoring people, to recognize others' kindness and to render benefit in return, sort of the basic good human transaction. Somebody does something for you, you repay it. To protect beings from dangers, to alleviate the distress of those who are suffering, to provide those deprived of resources with provisions to feed the needy and so forth. And then there's a few more, and they all fall under the heading to share the Dharma with people if you have that, and you can do that. So that's what the jewel ornament says. What Gompopa says is the Buddha's teaching on ethics. So it's all there. I think, and I've said this before, I think there's a little bit of an emphasis right now. There seems to be people, even amongst Buddhist teachers, who think that somehow Buddhism is missing this element of actively helping others, and that we're just sitting on our cushions, and that that's what Buddhism is all about, but it's not. You know, this is 12th century text that says, get out there and help people, but don't ignore, like, your own training to be able to help them more effectively. And just to come back to Geshe Jampa Tekchup for a moment, because I interrupted him mid-paragraph, he says, for example, if we are untrained in medicine, is it better for us to treat people now as best we can, or to leave that aside to go to medical school? Would you want to be treated by a doctor who had not spent his or her 4 years in medical school, because it would seem like a waste of time because there are so many sick people who need help? I think it's a really apt analogy. So similarly, we benefit others however we can now. So we're not waiting until we're completely enlightened. We help them now, but we put most of our effort into Dharma practice so that we can continuously increase our ability to be of service. If we ignore developing our internal qualities and strengths, our ability to help will remain limited, and we will be more likely to suffer from compassion fatigue, which we sometimes, I think, also call burnout later on, and give up helping others altogether. So we need to work on expanding our capacity. I think it's been thoroughly hammered in now. But to me, that's like a really important theme of this verse. So anybody have any questions or comments at this point? Okay, Chet.
I may be a little concrete about this, but I keep getting hung up on this level thing between the first, second, and third level, mm-hmm. not only because I see references to things like lesser people and mediocre persons, and so it has this kind of very, I don't know, judgmental quality to it. Is there a way to step back from that?
Well, what's happening here is that we are reading the literal words that were written in a time when this was the language that was used. In the same way that we have, like, nobody says Hinayana anymore because it literally translates to lesser vehicle, and that's considered disrespectful. You won't find anybody, hardly anybody. And you'll see it in Dingo Chensi because he was writing, like, he died in 1991. You know, like, things have changed a lot in terms of, like, political correctness and so forth and sensitivity, you know. So you'll see Hinayana in Dingo Chensi, but you won't see it like in Minjo Rinpoche, you know, for example. Like anybody who's teaching now, they avoid the use of that term because it's now considered to be sort of insensitive to call somebody lesser, a lesser vehicle. Same thing here. We wouldn't call it. But at the same time, the Hinayana is a lesser vehicle in the sense that its scope is lesser. It's just individual liberation. So it's not inaccurate. And so in the same way, I think calling the being motivated to practice the Dharma by wanting to not suffer yourself in the future, it's a lesser motivation than to want to attain complete freedom for all beings. What we're seeing, and I think that what you're reacting to is it's actually not motivations, but beings, like the path for lesser beings, the path for mediocre beings, and the path for... Anyways, that's just a terminology that's dating here from, you know, many centuries ago.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I get the motivation part and I understand that. And okay. I think it's just when I start saying, like I was trying to look up a reference and when it said the middle path referred to mediocre beings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what's a mediocre being?
Well, that's just the terminology they use, right. But I'm not sure that they meant that, like, we don't all have all of them. I think it's a temporary condition that right now, the only way that you're able to motivate yourself to practice, like your vision is limited to, like, get me out of this suffering, or I don't want to go to the hell realms, so I'm going to work to liberate myself. That would be just one stage of a being. But at that time, that's that person. I mean, I can't really speak to it because I don't really know that much about the culture. But
actually,
I think
what makes sense is what you just said, which is the idea of stages.
Yeah.
That's probably more of a Western concept to talk about things in stages. Get that.
But to get into something that's really, like, could really be insensitive, like, the question is very much alive right now. Was Thomas Jefferson a bad person because he owned slaves? You know, it was a different time. Yeah. And now we look back in horror that anybody could ever own slaves, but it was a different time. I grew up in an era, and many of us did, when, like, women were really denigrated quite publicly. Black people in the South, you know, denigrated quite publicly. And you don't hear so much. I mean, now it's like in the news, but really, like, the cultural standard has shifted quite a bit now. But were those bad people? You know, they were just living in a really different time. So I don't think that there's any disrespect there. It's just a different way of perceiving things. Is my answer to it.
Good answer. Thanks.
We lose people on the Dharma Path program because they get to the chapter on, I guess all of the chapters have it. There's stuff in there that really offends people in the Torch of Certainty. Zhang Gongkongtuo writing in the 19th century about, like, men versus women or animals being stupid. We've lost people from the Dharma Path because they're so offended by somebody calling animals stupid. It was just a way of describing, like, that animals can't become enlightened directly because they don't have the faculties, but it was considered stupidity at that time. So it's just a different... Kathy, did you have something to say? Okay. Yeah, you're unmuted.
Okay. And oftentimes it's the translator of the text, not necessarily what the text is. And that I've learned over the years to give that a lot of leeway. You know, sometimes the translation is just, you know, offensive.
Yeah. Well, it's true, a translation done 30 years ago would translate it differently now. But that's our sensitivity. And the earlier translation may be quite literal. But we know better now. We know better now. But that's the way they said it, because it was 19th century medieval culture.
Yeah. You know?
So it's not something we can solve, but we definitely have more sensitivity now. And that's why I would never call it the three, you know, levels of beings or the three levels of practitioners. It's the three levels of motivation. Marilyn, I'm unmuting you.
Just a quick note, we're dealing with things, a feudal society in which everybody had a rank and a status, very, you know, was delineated by clothing and not just how much food you had. So, I mean, given that kind of mindset, of course, everything is, you know, one's better than the other and one's higher and one's lower. It's just the way things were thought of.
Yeah. Okay, anybody have anything else to say on that topic? John?
Yeah, yes. Well, back to the text you read a little while ago. And so it said, but if you establish all beings in the Dharma, you'll help them in ways that are both immediately beneficial and beneficial to the future of the person, rather than just doing the temporary limited relief. But I was, then that reminded me of that, wasn't it in the Bodhisattva path at some point to wait and let everyone go before, you know, I won't achieve enlightenment till everybody does. So then I guess my question here or issue is, let me just pull it up so I can read it. Does this mean that if we don't have that, if we don't have to wait for all beings to become enlightened before ourselves, we can also not only just be the boat that carries them across to samsara, but also we can teach them to build their own boat and how to row it.
Right.
That makes sense?
Yeah, it does. I think one of the classic descriptions of a bodhisattva, like the difference between a bodhisattva and a Buddha, is that a bodhisattva puts off full Buddhahood until everybody is enlightened and continues to come back in the body, embodied, to help people in that way. Because a Buddha has the option to just rest in the Dharmakaya and some Buddhas never teach. They can just rest. Like that's the benefit of being a Buddha. The self-benefit of being a Buddha is that you can just rest in the Dharmakaya undisturbed forever. So the Bodhisattva intention is what keeps people who are at that level of enlightenment, it is said, keeps them coming back in a body like tulkus, who could choose to not come back in a body or could choose how to come back in a body. They come back in the body where they can most benefit people. So that's, I guess, part of the Bodhisattva aspiration. So yeah, it's like you learned it and you teach it. You know, instead of just going off and being a scholar, maybe you put it back, you give back to society.
Okay, so it didn't just mean that it's better and that it, again, it's better that do the lasting, teaching, giving up the Dharma rather than the immediate temporary things, but they're both beneficial.
Yeah. And
ultimately, if we get to the point, the second would be the better choice or something like that.
The second meaning, what's the second?
Sharing in the Dharma and, that benefiting him in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, I think the main point here for me is it's not an either or situation. they must have gotten the same criticisms back, in the 12th century. Like, why are you sitting in a monastery, meditating when there are people starving? So you feed them, if you can, but you don't have to devote your entire life to feeding people and not then pursue the Dharma. You want to do both. Mm-hmm. So you never give up helping people in a worldly way if you can relieve their suffering, but it's not selfish to also spend time developing your own capacity. Is that getting at what you're bringing up?
Yeah, it does. And it's just pointing out further to me that I have to have the perspective while studying this, which I didn't have before, that it's intertwined. It's not just one way. There's no one way. You got to look at it from both angles.
Yeah.
Almost all the time.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. There was somebody else waving at me? Okay. We have about a little less than 10 minutes, and I have probably a couple more passages from Geshe Jompa Tegcho. Anybody have anything before I do that? Yes, Marilyn.
If there's time after that, I'd like to bring up a little tiny paragraph from what you're reading from that you've already gone by. I don't know whether if there
is. Do you want to just go ahead and do that? Because I think we've covered it. I don't have a particular agenda. I just had some passages marked. I'm happy to spend the time on that.
Well, okay. It just really struck me on...
Which book is this?
Yeshe Jompa Tegcho.
Okay. Right.
159, where he says that nowadays many people are interested in the tantric practices of visualizing deities. It is important to know that some level of bodhicitta is a prerequisite to those practices, and to actualize the beneficial results of tantra, we must have bodhicitta. And my only point is, we do say bodhicitta prayers before we do chenrezig.
Yeah.
This really pinpoints, or, you know, medicine Buddha or whatever, but this really pinpoints, you really have to go for that bodhicitta aspiration in order to really have your tantric practice or your visualization practice really have import. And that's all I wanted to say, but I just thought that was so crucial.
Yes, thanks for sharing that. I appreciate when people are, you know, moved or, you know, by a particular passage and they share it. So, yeah. And it's the same thing. Like, this is the foundation. And I think that's addressed to people. And we encounter them all the time. People who don't think they need the preliminaries. They want to go straight to Dzogchen and Mahamudra. You've got to have bodhicitta. You have to develop bodhicitta. That's the method. Dzogchen and Mahamudra are the wisdom. But you have to have the method, and the method is bodhicitta. It's relative bodhicitta method, generosity, and all of those other paramitas, you know, with wisdom being the wisdom. So we need it all. It's all foundational. Just like practice 8, refraining from harm, is the foundation of all liberation for oneself and for others. Anybody else? All right, so I'm going to see what else I have in Jampa, Geshe Jampa Tekcho. Right, he has a meditation, which I hinted at in my class notes, and it's worth doing this. He presents, it's a very Gelugpa presentation. He says there are two methods to generate and then stabilize bodhicitta, and the first one is what he calls the 7 cause and effect instructions. I'm not going to go into those. It's just basically it's a metta, like a loving kindness meditation. It's a Gelugpa presentation, but it's a lovely meditation. And then the other one is exchanging self and others, which we do. That will be verse 11, where we do tonglen, taking and sending. But he says to meditate on equanimity. So he talks about equanimity as an important basis for bodhicitta. And again, we've talked about equanimity as not meaning indifference. It's not like a neutral state of mind. It just means that we apply love and compassion to all beings equally, which is how we started out this session, I think, this study. It's like everybody, we're saving everybody. So he says, this is how you can, I think this is a really lovely method for developing equanimity. And again, I have it a little bit described in the class notes. To meditate on equanimity, we think of a person whom we dislike. Let's just do that for a second. We're just going to try this for 1 minute. Somebody you don't like, political figure, personal person at work, could be anybody, but we could all come up with somebody. Rubs us the wrong way. Just keep them in mind right now. We're not doing anything. Bring to mind also alongside that person, somebody that we're very fond of. So we're putting them right together in our visual field. And then a person towards whom we're neutral. We don't have to do a neutral person. Let's keep it really simple in interest of like time. So consider, let's just think about this disagreeable person. It probably should be somebody you know personally. Let's just make that adjustment if needed. Consider that our relationship with the disagreeable person has not always been what it is now, hopefully. Earlier in this life, perhaps he or she helped us. And definitely in previous lives, he was our friend and helped us many times. Usually, however mean somebody is to us, we can think of some way in which they're kind to us. And I've told the story many times of how in my 3-year retreat, when interactions could get tense, I kept a list of the way each person in retreat with me had been kind to me so that I could look at that when they made me mad. It really helped. So just think of some way in which that person that you don't like has been kind to you. And think of some way in which that person that you love has maybe harmed you in some way. And maybe at one point has felt like an enemy. And we don't have time to really sit here with that right now, but I think it's a really worthwhile meditation to do. And by doing that, it helps to equalize our feelings toward both of them and to understand that nobody is permanently a loved one and no one is permanently an enemy. It switches all the time. And if you pay attention, 3-year retreat is a great venue for this when you're in close with the same people all the time to see how it shifts back and forth. You out ally with one person and against another person, and then vice versa, and people are nice to you and they're mean to you. Anyway, so I just want to look at, there's so much in this this chapter. So bodhicitta itself, through the 7-point process, which we're not going into, begins when we see that at the moment we are not able to free even ourselves from suffering and conjoin ourselves with happiness, let alone do this for countless sentient beings. If we think about that for a second, that we can't even make ourselves happy all the time, we can't even make our own mind peaceful all the time, how can we even think about helping other beings in any meaningful way, any permanent, lasting way? So that's our aspiration. He says, the only person who has the ability to do that is a fully enlightened being, a Buddha. Such a person can work for all beings according to their interests and dispositions. It is only by becoming a Buddha ourselves that we will be able to actualize this deepest wish. Therefore, we make the decision that for the sake of all sentient beings, we will attain the state of enlightenment. So I'm going to leave it there, except for just a little... Pema Chodron, by the way, did not have a commentary on verses 10 and 11 because she left that to Tim Olmsted, and he did a meditation, and I didn't take notes. So we don't have her commentary on 10 and 11. Just Kempo Sultram Jamsar Rinpoche, and I don't usually bring him into it because it's very, very Tibetan-oriented, like Tibet culture-oriented. But here he says... the chapters in Gampopa's Jewel Ornament of Liberation on loving kindness and compassion offer guidance and help. I advise you to read these chapters again and again, to meditate on them and to practice them so that you will give rise to the real attitude of the Mahayana. So here you have an endorsement for reading, an encouragement to really study the chapters on loving kindness and compassion in the Jewel Ornament or in Ringu Tulku's commentary, Path to Buddhahood, or any other text. Like, really immerse yourselves in this, and you will benefit, according to Kempo Sultram. Any parting words before we do our prayers? Okay. So next week, the topic, verse 11, is compassion and Tonglen. We will officially be doing taking and sending meditation, beginning with that verse. And the homework I wrote is to recite verse 11, which I'm still working on the translation. I am not ahead as I was before. Do taking and sending every day as part of your meditation this week. And also, yeah, that's it. And then Hello. Bring questions and share experience. Yeah? Hello? Okay, I guess that's background talking. Oh, that's Kathy. Okay, I'm going to mute. Just do some Tonglen every day for the next week and bring in any questions and experiences that you have. And that will be the basic topic of next week. John.
Just a quick comment, if I could.
Yeah.
When you were talking about the equanimity, about bringing the person that you like and the person you don't like together in one thought, and reminded me of high school.
You mean that's how high school was?
Well, yeah, one day you're friends with this person, next day, yeah. You know, who knows?
Yes, that's another one of those microcosms, like, you know, sort of cauldrons or whatever. Yeah, where you can really see those patterns clearly. Yes, Fanny, you were not at your seat at the very beginning of class, and we talked a lot about people in the path of the storm. So thanks for that reinforcement. Prayers for all in the wrath of the storm. Okay, so let's do our dedication prayers. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate all virtue fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate.
the blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. Okay, everybody's unmuted. Those who don't have to rush away right now, if anybody has any...